like to bring this meeting of House Finance Committee to order. It is 1:33 on Friday, February 2nd. Present are Representative Kawasaki, Representative Newman, Vice Chair Guerra, Representative Tilton, Representative Grand, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Thompson and Ortiz are excused today, and myself, Butcher Seaton, I'm here. And Wilson is, Representative Wilson is excused as well. So before we start, remind everybody about their cell phones to check them. And at this meeting, we are going to have the first hearing on House Bill 215, an act relating to program receipts and relating to the fees for services provided by the Department of Health. And this bill is by the House Finance Committee. And after that, we will have our second hearing on HB 142, Unemployment Compensation Benefits, by Representative Tuck. We had a brief introduction on that bill on May 9th, and we'll be taking testimony, a review of that, and then we'll be having testimony on both bills today. Is there anything else to come before the committee before we get started? Seeing none, the first bill up will be House Bill 215, and the committee has the CS before them in their packet. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 215, version 30-LS0673/O, as the committee's working draft.
And I'll object for discussion. Can we have committee aide, representative, I mean, my staff, Elizabeth Diamant, come up, and also Jill Lewis, deputy director from the Alaska Division of Public Health. And you ready to put yourself on the record first and then run through the changes that are incorporated in the CS?
Sure. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Diamond, and I have staff to Representative Seaton. And with me is Jill Lewis, Deputy Director, Division of Public Health.
And before we go forward, I recognize Representative Pruitt has joined us.
Okay. All right. So we're here today to introduce HB 215, Public Health Fees, which is a Finance Committee-sponsored bill. And this bill would amend AS 4429022A to grant the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services the authority to collect fees to support the administration of public health programs. So how this bill came about is last year during the Finance Subcommittee process, public health was identified as a division that could be charging additional fees where appropriate and reasonable to support its mission. Currently, however, the department is not able to charge fees for all its potential health-related services because it is limited in its authority by statute to charge fees. So the department presented to the committee a proposal to gain authority to charge fees over other public health services it provides not already covered in statute. So HB 215 gives this authority to the department to charge fees for any public health services it provides under AS 18, as well as tobacco control programs under AS 4429020. And HB 215 in Section 1 also adds the fees created to the list of program receipts accounted for separately under AS 3705146C, which makes clear that those fees collected would be used to support public health operations and would be in DGF. So Jill Lewis is here from the Division of Public Health, and she'll go into a little more detail and provide some examples of what kind of services the division is looking to charge fees for. Before she does, I'm just going to speak to the changes in Version O, which is the draft committee substitute before you for adoption. So during hearings in the HES committee, a stakeholder concern was brought forward regarding public and stakeholder input in the regulatory process. And that concern was that by taking the discussion of charging fees out of the legislative process and putting it into the regulatory process, that the public would not have adequate input in the initial planning stages. Within the regulatory process, public comment comes after the regulations are drafted, and the train has kind of left the station. So we agreed to continue discussing this concern over the interim and held a stakeholder meeting with the Division of Public Health, our office, and ASHNA, the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. And Section 3 of this CS is the result of that discussion, and that is what was added to the bill. And Section 3 adds a requirement in statute that the department hold initial scoping meetings, including one public meeting, for all new fees that it creates under this expanded authority. In practice, the department already plans to hold these meetings, and there's also precedent in statute for requiring these meetings for other setting fees in other situations. So that is the one change. This results in the CS from version J to version O. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Jill Lewis, and she'll go through this short slide presentation.
And before we do that, are there questions about the CS? Seeing none, I'm going to remove my objection to adopting the CS as our working document. Is there any further objection to adoption of the CS? Seeing none, we have version O as our working document. Go ahead, Ms. Lewis, would you go ahead and introduce yourself on the record and proceed?
Thank you very much. I'm Jill Lewis, Deputy Director for the Alaska Division of Public Health. I appreciate very much being able to speak to you today on House Bill 215. The Division of Public Health focuses on services that protect and improve the public's health status through programs that address the health of every Alaskan and community. Public health services control infectious diseases, prevent chronic diseases and injuries, promote healthy lifestyles, and protect maternal and child health. In our slide presentation today, I want to draw attention to the fact that we already have certain fee authority. We're able to charge fees for some select clinical services that we provide. We can collect fees primarily for clinical laboratory and public health nursing services, certified copies of vital records, clinics for children who need to see specialists. But these are only a few of the fees that we, of the services that we provide, and we aren't able to charge fees other than for the list you see in front of you. This is a finance committee, so I wanted to share some of our division finance on how much fees we collect already. This slide shows the various funding sources that the division has, and the general fund program receipts in red, the pie slice that's slightly pulled out, is how much we collect in fees currently. That is close to $7 million out of a $117 million budget.
Yeah, might as well get this out now. So the fiscal note says these fees will raise roughly a net of $400,000 a year. Just can you let the committee know? I don't think that's going to replace the money that we're about to run out of, and there are two funds that we have. One is an alcoholism treatment-related fund, and then the tobacco settlement fund isn't going to last forever. Can you I guess for the more immediate one, the first one is possibly going to run out by next year. Is that correct? And how much will we not be getting from that anymore?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the Division of Public Health does not receive any money from the alcohol fund, so I don't really feel that I'm the best person to speak to that. However, we do receive funds from the tobacco fund. They receive about $8 million a year currently, which is also shown on the slide. For the last 5 or 6 years, we've been aware of declining revenues in the tobacco fund, and we have taken steps with our partners to reduce our expenditures in the tobacco fund. And in fact, we have a $375,000 decrement in the governor's budget this year to help to address the sustainability of the fund in the long term. And we also expect that we will be doing further reductions in the future so that we can spend within our means. These fees that we're going to collect would not be part of the tobacco fund, and they wouldn't address those issues. They would go into what we call the general fund program receipts, and they would be redirected to the program itself that generated the fees. So if we were able to generate fees for radiologic health, and they would go to support radiologic health.
Thank you.
No further questions, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you go through the slide, Ms. Lewis, could you delineate where new money is coming into the program? I mean, services for, I mean, the tobacco funds, you know, we can put whatever we want on top of that. That's not a concern of mine. But, you know, vaccine assessments or many other services, Who's paying them? Is it new money? Are we just charging the insurance industry? Are we charging the clients? Are we charging the state? Is it just cycling the money around so more comes off into the public health budget? Not necessarily a problem, but I'd like to understand how that happens when we're charging for fees and programs. And I understand if somebody can't afford it, they won't be paying for it. But, you know, some of the charges, the insurance industry, which just comes around and comes in back in, and it becomes an increased fee charge to the program itself. So when you're going through this, can you delineate that difference between just rehashing old money and new money that's coming in to take care of this?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I will do my very best to try and address that as we go through. I have a few examples of the initial fees that we would probably pursue. These are identified services that we haven't been able to do because we don't have the revenues for them anymore. And I'm hoping that that will help to answer some of your questions.
Thank you.
So as Liz explained, currently public health lacks fee authority for many of the other services and functions. We have looked at expanding our clinical fee collections, and what we have determined is that we're fairly well maximizing the fees that we already are able to collect. And our greatest opportunity comes in areas that aren't in the current list, in professional services and administrative functions. And some examples of those you'll see on the side. We don't have the authority to charge fees for specialized analyses. We are frequently requested to do that. Provider trainings, expert consultations, and also some of our inspections, particularly for the radiologic health program, where we aren't able to do that. So there's a number of protections that are already built into the law that constrain how we can go about setting our fees and how much of a fee we would charge. The fees would be waived if they are not in the public interest or if they are not economically feasible to collect. And we would not institute fees if they were going to undermine the division's public health mission. And sometimes charging a fee does, in fact, create a barrier to someone getting using services, and so that might not serve our mission. We do not deny services because of an inability to pay. We are limited to only charging fees for the actual cost, and we're required to do regulations for every fee that we set. And, Mr. Chair, that's the end of my presentation. Happy to answer questions.
Great. Thank you,
Ms. Chair. I was interested in this fees waived. If they're not in the public interest, I understand you probably that's a general policy statewide anyhow on a lot of fees that you're currently collecting on. Do we see any indications regionally where this is used more than others? You know, so more areas of the state that where you'd be able to, the poverty level is higher, or where the economy is worse. Could we get some information on where we would see this fees waived? Because I think it would give an indicator of where the most need is, because I think you're going to probably use the same people. Is that accurate, and is that information available?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, we do have information on the fees that are waived. There's actually a state report that we're required to do periodically, along with all the other agencies in the state that talks about how much we did not collect, in fact. And we can look at whether or not we can do that regionally. Currently with the, if I could move the slides back up, I don't like to make people's eyes roll what move slides, but the things that we can charge fees for now, the largest one that we can collect fees for are the public health nursing services, and they have a sliding fee scale that's based on income. So where income is lower, you would see more proportion you know, on the sliding fee scale that have been waived.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's kind of important because a lot of times, you know, we're talking about the economy right now and effects of Alaskans and taxes on the public. And it's kind of nice to see where the needier areas in the state are. So if we kind of get information on that. And I had one other question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
When we're on page one of the bill, and I guess in a sentence and further on, it talks about these being program receipts. And I noticed that they're listed in as dedicated receipts. They become as dedicated receipts, and it's only 8 million of 100 million, so it's a very small percentage of them. But I wonder why they would not be fund coded as a general fund program receipts in there so that the legislature can see that money moving through easier.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the fees that we collect would be considered designated general fund, so they'd be classified as the DGF, not the undesignated general fund, the UGF. And so they are part of the general fund, but they would be classified as DGF.
I understand. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kawasaki was next.
Thank you. Can we go to the last slide again? I guess this is for Ms. Lewis on the last slide. The fees waived, and then the first bullet and the second bullet are in statute under Section 2 of the bill. Where is the third bullet actually located?
The third bullet is not in law. The third bullet is just our philosophy of how we would approach fees. A fee would not be in the public interest if it undermined our public health mission.
Okay. Okay, good enough. And then a follow or a different question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the fiscal note, it shows just some examples of areas in which you would like the ability to implement a fee because you don't have current authority. And I just had a question on all of the four different ones that are listed to complete the fiscal note. The first one is for inspections of radiological devices like X-rays you already currently have, and then it's for MRIs, CTs, ultraviolet devices. So that first bullet, the person or the people, the person who would be paying that is a clinic then? Is that the case?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, that's correct. That wouldn't be an individual patient because we don't perform the X-ray service. We perform the inspection. So it would be the facility, the clinic, who has the radiologic device that we are inspecting.
And then for the – thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then going just down the list, the second one and then the third one and the fourth one. The second one, I assume, would be the folks that have loan repayments to do. And then if you could just go down and explain who's paying those – who will be paying those fees directly.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, thank you very much. In each of these cases, it is likely – that it is going to be some type of an organization that would be paying it as opposed to an individual. The administrative fee for the loan repayment program would be paid by the employers of the practitioners who are receiving the loan repayment program. The custom statistical and epidemiological analyses and other types of data that we would be able to charge for would depend on who was requesting it. It might be a nonprofit organization. It might be a research organization. It could be a local government. We get requests from a wide variety of entities, and then we would be able to but that's who would be paying for those.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And Representative Tolkien.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And one of my questions was answered was on the fiscal note on the administration of the loan repayments, and so that would be paid by the employer who is benefiting from that. And then on the fourth bullet, you talk about turning away requests for community health assessments and action plans. But then because there was not enough says the division lost the capacity for the service when the position funded with unrestricted general funds was eliminated in the recent budget cut. But then it goes on to say that no new positions are needed. So can you explain why you would not need a new position for that?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, that is an excellent question. In all of these cases, if we are looking at funding a position, we would utilize existing positions. The Division of Public Health has roughly 426 positions, I think, and currently I think we have close to 50 vacancies. Before we fill any vacancy, we always look at all of the priorities across the division to see what is needed most. And so we may not have that particular position anymore, but we would look at the available positions we have and then look to use one of our existing positions rather than seeking additional staffing. And that would be true for any of the positions that that we might be talking about here that aren't currently staffed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if Ashton is here, but in their statement and their paper, they talk about appreciating their concerns being incorporated into the bill, the new version. If are they here to testify today? Are they on the list?
Guttenberg, we can ask them to come up and verify.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I'll that time. Thank you.
Are there further questions? Seeing none, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just because on the fiscal analysis, on the bottom paragraph, it said that new implementation of the fees would begin in 2020. I'm assuming that so this year's fees, is any of this money included in the fiscal year 19 budget in anticipating covering operating expenses or authority?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, we have no additional fees that are reflected in this bill included in the governor's budget for FY19. And we would the reason that we aren't reflecting any fees collected in FY19 in the fiscal note is because that would be a year for us to do the cost analyses and to have the regulatory process and to have the preliminary discussions with our stakeholders in order to determine what we and go through that process in order to determine what fees we actually could possibly collect, which would probably start in fiscal year 2020.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just to follow up on that.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the follow-up on that would be, do you anticipate any additional money in this year's budget to cover those costs? I'm just wondering if you're thinking how much positive. Is there any money in this year's budget for any implementation of any of this?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, that's an excellent question. Thank you. These are not services that we are currently able to do. And in some cases, we used to do them, and we no longer have the funding to do them, so we discontinued them. And we are being asked by our partners and stakeholders to continue doing these services. This is why we chose these particular ones initially. So we do not have money in the current budget. We would not be asking for money, and right now we are not doing those services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Do you know the questions? Can I ask for Jeannie Monk?
Sure, thanks. My name is Jeannie Monk, and I'm with the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Monk, could you talk about what your original concerns were and how they were incorporated into the new version?
Yeah. Thanks. Our original concern was that there be an opportunity for stakeholders to provide input prior to the regulation process beginning, that once the regulation process begins, the department isn't allowed to consult with stakeholders, and we can always provide public comment, but that's pretty late in the process. And so we wanted to ensure that there was an opportunity for those who would be impacted by potential fees to have a dialogue prior to the regulation process beginning.
If I may, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. And how do you think these, well, it's broad authority to implement the fees. How do you think they would affect not just the hospital, so the hospitals and the state, but the all of the down, not down ballots, the wrong question, but everybody downstream from the hospitals including the person just walking into a clinic for a vaccination.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I don't, that's kind of a complicated question. I'm not quite sure. I guess I would say anytime you add more regulatory burden to hospitals or clinics, and it costs money for them to comply, that expense has to be paid by somebody. And so that is a concern of if you add additional regulatory burden, those costs get passed on to consumers in some way or another. I think many of the fees that they are looking at would not have that impact. But there certainly is that opportunity that that could happen. And that was why we wanted an opportunity to have dialogue from the beginning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Gere.
Thank you. I think that's for Ms. Lewis, but anybody at the table who wants to answer it. The way our regulatory process works right now is, I mean, you hope with good government that when somebody's adopting a regulation, they'll speak to somebody first, right? But then there's public comment, and then the regulations either get changed or they don't get changed. And so this is a new process where there's an extra level of stakeholder, which is mostly medical provider comment, I would guess. But are we worried, Ms. Lewis, that I'm just wondering whether that extra layer of regulatory steps is going to eat up what minor amount of money this bill raises. So do you have any estimate as to what that might cost every time you want to look at a fee change?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I think that we would be able to absorb any cost associated with meeting with stakeholders. We meet with stakeholders every day on a variety of topics, and so I don't think that that would put any extra pressure on our budget. The difference, because we'll have different fees and public health scope is so broad, we will have different stakeholders for pretty much every fee. The stakeholders for radiologic health might include hospitals and clinics, but for community assessments, it's more likely to be nonprofits or local governments. So, you know, we wouldn't be able to do them all together, and we wouldn't want to because we wouldn't have the right people in the room. And I will say we had already intended to do this initially because we need that input from stakeholders. We're talking about establishing fees that we don't do now, and so we need to understand that. We need to make sure that we are not undermining our public health mission and that we are setting up the fees in a reasonable way. And so we had intended to do this, and the change for this version just puts that in as part of the process into law. So we're very much in support of that.
All right. That's good enough for me. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Kelso.
Thank you. Representative Guttenberg sort of asked a similar question, and I think I'm okay with the answer. But I did have a question. I guess this would be mostly for Ms. Lewis on you've only cited in the fiscal note 4 that you're planning on implementing because they're either the most useful or the most frequently asked for in recent past. And I'm just wondering how deep and you can get back to me on how deep it goes, but this entire Title 18 would go because it's added to the Administration of Public Health. It goes on to say the fee established cannot exceed the actual cost, but the commissioner gets to define what the actual cost is by regulation. And I'm not sure if I'm really comfortable with the language as it's written, but if you can give me like a list, a fairly comprehensive list of all the potential fees that could be out there in the future that would be done by regulation. Thanks.
Through the chair to Representative Kawasaki, these four are the only four that we've identified right now today. And so these are the first ones. The reason that we have asked for broader fee authority, though, than just specifically these four, is a few years ago we didn't know that we might need a fee for community health assessments. Historically, public health agencies have relied on federal and state funding, and in our fiscal situation, we need to face the reality that where it is reasonable to charge fees, public health doesn't mean free health. It isn't free. And so where it's reasonable to charge a fee. there may be things in the future that develop that come to our attention that we're not aware of today. I hope that's a satisfactory answer. I would add that any fee that we needed to do in the future, we would have the pre-meetings with the stakeholders, and we would go through a regulatory process, so there would be public input into any action that we took in the future. We would not just set up a new fee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions? I think I forgot to open the public testimony before I had you come up, so I'm going to make sure I open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 215? There is. So, go ahead and sit back so that. Yeah, come on up. Identify yourself.
I was also signed up for public testimony, but I don't need to.
You
want me to stay or go or come back?
If you're public testimony, that's fine. Go ahead. We'll take your testimony.
I'm Jeannie Monk with the Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association. I think you all have my written comments in your packet, and so I don't have anything substantially to add, but to let you know that we do support the legislation with this, the increased stakeholder involvement, and we do think that is a very important piece. Even if the current administration is supportive of a process, we want to ensure that in the future there is a process to make sure stakeholders are involved prior to new fees being initiated. So thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Representative Newman? I don't know if this is a question for her or not, but I've just been curious about this, and since she represents nursing homes, I don't know if this affects Pioneer Homes and how it would affect that, because those are state-run, and that would be different, you know, as a private organization or industry, as nursing homes like this. So are we increasing regulation fees in one industry where you're basically serving the same clients and not the other? And how do you feel about
through
that?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I don't believe that the bill as it exists now, although other people probably better speak to it, specifically has fees that would impact either hospitals or nursing homes, but it does give them the opportunity to charge those. And so whether those would impact Pioneer Homes, who are also part of our association, or nursing homes, I think would depend on the fee. But from what's being proposed, it doesn't sound to me like right now any of those fees would impact them, but we'd have to know details.
Okay, thank you. And if you want more definition on that, we can get Jill up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably just whether this is going to affect Pioneer Homes or not.
Representative Kawasaki, did you have a question?
Thanks. This is more just on ASHNA, and I should know, and I know the acronym, and the building's right across the street, but can you kind of explain, as an organization, who you represent? Do you represent community health centers, regional public health centers, small clinics, those types of things, and just your who do you represent?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. ASHNA is the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, and we represent Alaska's hospitals and skilled nursing facilities. So that is all. There are 27 hospitals. Many of them have a skilled nursing facility that is part of the hospital. There are also standalone nursing homes that we represent. The Pioneer Home is part of our association. Some of our members, particularly the tribal members, so all of the tribal hospitals are also members, also operate community health centers. And so although we don't specifically look at those, they are part of the work they do. A number of our hospitals also operate rural health clinics. So they provide a wide spectrum of services. Some provide home health services, hospice services. But it's all under the umbrella of a hospital or a skilled nursing facility.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Further questions for the ASHNA representative? Thank you very much. And now we have Tom Chard. Welcome. Would you go ahead and put your name and who you represent on for the record, and go ahead with your testify.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Seaton, and thank you to House Finance for hearing this bill today and for allowing public testimony. Typically, I am sitting before you as the Executive Director of the Alaska Behavioral Health Association, and just to provide the information, the Alaska Behavioral Health Association represents the mental health and substance abuse treatment providers across the state. I also happen to serve as the current chair of the SHARP Council. The SHARP Council is the loan repayment program that was established in statute. It also has purview over the SHARP 1 program, which is federally funded, the SHARP 2 program, which was created in statute, and soon to be, hopefully, the SHARP 3 program, a public-private partnership that we're super excited about. The SHARP Council consists of 18 members. They are typically representatives from associations such as ASHNA. The 18 members include dentists, doctors, behavioral health, just a wide gamut of employers and associations. The SHARP program has been around for about 10 years and has been administering contracts for that period of time. To date, we have administered 250 contracts with over 57 sites across the state. So many of your communities have healthcare practitioners that take advantage of the student loan repayment and support offered through the federal government in support. The SHARP Council discussed HB 215. It was mentioned in Director Lewis's report. There were some important considerations that we had during that discussion. The support offered by the Division of Public Health, their staff, they've been successful in bringing millions of dollars into our state for healthcare practitioner support. And they've administered the program for, like I said, 10 years, over 10 years. The consideration of Alaska's current economic challenges and the pressure on state services, the consideration of the important role that the SHARP program serves in supporting access to quality health. And we also wrestled with the employer match and the employers contributing to this important program. Ultimately, the 18 members of the SHARP Council support and voted to support HB 215 and the administrative fees that might result from it for our program. We also appreciate the additional opportunity to help guide the program through this latest subcommittee substitute. So appreciate that, and happy to answer any questions that anyone might have about the SHARP Council's support of HB 215.
And thank you. Are there any questions? I'm seeing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 215? Is there anyone online? There's no one online. I will close public testimony. Committee discussion. Is there any discussion of the bill?
Just really briefly, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question to Kate Glover if she's on, still online from Legislative Legal?
Ms. Glover, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. Kate, this is Representative Guerra. So I'm going to support the bill, but I just... to the extent you know, do you know of any other process in regulations where we don't, where we have this additional layer required by statute before the regulation process starts? I don't know that I want to do this in every single bill as we go forward.
This is Kate Glover through the chair. Representative Garrett, you're just referring to the additional consultation that's required?
By statute, yeah.
Through the chair, I am not aware of another place where that is required, though something in my memory is telling me this language is similar to something I looked at. So I couldn't say with certainty that there is nothing else in statute. I think it is, I don't think there's much, but the Administrative Procedure Act does require consultation after there's a proposal. This would require it beforehand.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Glover.
And Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think the public health aspect of the budget in the community is very important and strong advocate for those positions. My concern is, instead of getting a handle on health care, we're just slicing the pie one more time to have some dollars land in their part of the budget. I think it's much more important on a larger aspect of health is to just grab a hold of it, stop the ever-increasing costs, which are straddling and breaking the state, this state and every other state in the nation, including the federal level. I'm going to support the bill, but I think there's an aspect of it that's much more important, that the state simply needs to get control of its finances, but the finances of the healthcare community and how it, the cost of delivering services. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further comment? Ms. Lewis, did you have an answer to the question that was asked previously? I want to go back to Representative Garrett's question, although we addressed it to legislative, I believe Ms. Lewis had a question. So I'm going to bring her back up to, or has the answer. So if you come back up and put yourself back on the record.
Again, for the record, I'm Jill Lewis, Deputy Director for the Alaska Division of Public Health. Through the chair to Representative Guerra regarding whether or not there's a precedent already in law for consultation and in this kind of situation, as I apologize for the noise of flipping through my papers. There is one, I believe, in AS 4462-213. My notes don't say who this applies to. It authorizes the agency to contact a person about the development of the regulatory action and to answer questions from a person that's relevant to the development of the regulatory action. There are some other consultations that are required between our department and other departments, although they're not about the regulatory process.
Thank you. Is there any more discussion? Representative Guerra?
Mr. Chair, is it our intent to try and move this bill out of the committee today?
It was.
Yes.
That's the will of the committee. Unless there's a Representative Newman.
Just on that point then, Mr. Chair, I understand that the bill talks about having one meeting with the public. And Mr. Chair, years back we had another bill that had to deal with talking about the public. It was Senator Coghill's bill. And what we did is, at that time, is went to two public meetings with the concept that a lot of times when this stuff comes out in a public meeting is the first time people are become aware of it. And by then, you know, all the information's out there, but there's not another meeting for them to go to actually talk about after they find out the information. So, you know, I didn't know this was going to move today, or I would have had maybe an amendment ready to make it so there would be two meetings instead of one. And so I don't know at what time maybe a conceptual amendment that would say that they would have two meetings instead of one would be offered. But I would like to do that at the appropriate time.
If there's no objection, I'm perfectly willing to hold the bill for the next meeting, which will be...
Then it would be written.
On Monday, and we will bring it up under bills previously further scheduled. We won't be putting that on the schedule again because scheduling had to be done on Thursday. And so, but we do have... we'll take a brief at ease. Welcome back to order. yes, we'll have this bill. Actually, we do have it on the schedule for next Wednesday, so they'll have it at that time. So amendments should be submitted the day before, and we will have that to be submitted next time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So let's go to House Bill 142 at this time. We'll put this aside until next Wednesday.
Chair. Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg. Oh, we're still on record.
That's good.
Representative Guttenberg.
I asked the young lady in the back of the room what was she here for and what was this bill about. And she said this is going to help pay the mortgage. I would move the bill right now.
Thank you. So we now have HB 142 up, and Representative Tuck, appreciate it. Would you reintroduce the bill, because it's been since last May when we heard the bill?
Okay, yes, thank you. And speaking of paying the mortgage, thank you for co-chair Representative Seaton and Vice Chair Representative Guerra and committee members for hearing House Bill 142 another time. With me, I have Lennon Weller with Department of Labor and Patsy Westcott from Department of Labor as well. And actually, I just let them introduce themselves and give them their titles.
For the record, my name is Patsy Westcott. I'm Assistant Director with the Division of Employment and Training Services at the Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
And for the record, my name is Lennon Weller, and I'm an economist with the Department of Labor, and I also serve as the actuary to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund.
And for the record, I'm Representative Chris Tuck from District 23. So under our current statute, we have a maximum benefit right now of $370 a week for unemployment insurance. This legislation before you relates to the effectiveness of the Alaska's unemployment insurance program. Just a little bit of history. The National Unemployment Insurance System was originally created in 1935 by the Social Security Act. And then Congress chose to create a national system of compensation for unemployed workers based on an insurance model rather than an entitlement program. So the insurance model that we have here in the United States has been working for over 80 years, and as with most insurance programs, the objective is to underwrite an identified potential loss incurred by a small percentage of the insured through accumulation of funds collected from the group as a whole. And in this case, the loss insured by this program is the loss of wages by unemployed workers. And so the premiums required to cover this potential loss are, in most states, paid solely by the employer. However, here in the state of Alaska, the cost is shared between the employer and the worker. We're one of three states that does that, and in comparison, the other two states are a pittance on what the worker provides. Alaska does carry 73% of the direct cost. I'm sorry, the Alaska employers carry 73% of the direct costs, and the employees pay 27% of those costs through payroll taxes. So bringing the unemployment insurance from $370 up to $510 basically is meeting the United States Department of Labor's recommendation of a target of 50% of the wage replacement. There's been some studies that have been put out regarding the unemployment benefits and the stimulus to the economy. As we know right now, the state of Alaska is in some tough economic times right now. Number one is transportation projects in stimulating the economy. Number two is unemployment benefits. And when you look at there's been some studies. There's one that's done with Moody, and Moody had shown that for every dollar increase in unemployment benefits, $1.64 is added into the economy, which has quite the ripple effect. And I know there's been some concerns that people being unemployed, getting paid a little bit more while they're being employed, will prevent them from looking for jobs elsewhere. But the studies have shown to the contrary of that. One of the things that does happen is it marries workers up with the proper job down the road. Rather than a truck driver dropping into a fast food restaurant, they will find that truck driving job once again because it carries them through the seasonal work. And here in the state of Alaska, we do have one of the most seasonal industries in the United States, whether it's fishing, oil and gas, with the ice roads that have to be developed in the wintertime, with construction, with tourism industry. We're very seasonal up here in comparison. So when they compared a dollar increase in unemployment benefits, that creates about $19,000, I'm sorry, rather than going a dollar, $1 billion in unemployment benefit increases in the nation. It creates about 19,000 jobs. Comparing that to $1 billion in tax cuts only creates about 10,700 jobs in comparison. And one of the reasons why is because when someone is on unemployment, they're spending that money. They need to spend that money. They're spending that money on food, and then even that pays the truckers to deliver the food, that pays for the farmer who grows it, and has that trickle-down effect that actually brings that $1.64 back into the economy. And then when you compare that again with the tax cuts, that brings in about $1.19 back to the economy. And so it is a good bang for the buck, especially in the situation that we're in right now. So I'd like to just go over a little bit of the sectional, just so everybody understands how things are structured in this bill. So Section 1 amends the benefit schedule by increasing the maximum qualifying wage requirements from $42,000 to $59,500. That's giving us up, to bring us up to the 50% of what the U.S. Department of Labor recommends. The qualifying wage schedule is extended in $250 increments to reach the new maximum qualifying amount. The benefit schedule is extended in $2 increments for each additional $250 of qualifying wages to reach the new maximum weekly benefit amount of that $510. Section 2 amends Statute 2320-350 by adding a new subsection, H. Annually, after December 31st, 2019, authorized the department to increase the highest weekly benefit amount for individuals earning at least $59,750. The new weekly benefit amount calculation shall amend the highest base period wages in $250 increments and the highest weekly benefit amount in $2 increments if the state averages weekly wage increases. The new maximum weekly benefit amount shall not exceed 50% of the average weekly wage. Section I provides for public notice of any new benefit amounts calculated under H by December 1st of each year by posting a notice on the Alaska Online Public Notice System and allows for public comment on the accuracy of the department's calculations. New maximum weekly benefit amounts apply to benefit years established on January 1st of each year and does not change existing claims. Changes to the weekly benefit amounts shall be calculated only once per year. J establishes the calculation procedure for determining Alaska's average weekly wage by December 1st of each year. The average weekly wage is determined by dividing the average annual wage in the state for the preceding 12-month period ending June 30th by 52. The state must include wages of all employees in the state covered by this chapter, both public and private. If the calculation does not result in whole dollars, the amount shall be rounded down. And then Section 3, which we may have to change, provides for effective date of January 1st, 2018. I also want to point out that we are not changing the dependent factor. That remains the same. And with that, I'll allow you to ask us any questions.
Could you say that again?
Yeah, we are not changing the dependent factor. So there's a if you have dependents, your weekly benefit can go up. We're not changing that at all.
Further questions to the sponsor?
Thank you. Representative Tech, thank you for bringing the bill before us. I'm sure it's somewhere else in the statute, so the opposition from NFIB is their concern that they'll have to chip in a little bit more, but that's obviously not part of this bill. Just I take it there's another part of the statute that calculates the employer contribution?
And if you don't mind, I'll allow the Department of Labor to explain that. But, yeah, we're not changing the ratio between the employer and employee.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, yeah.
Two male voices, when either one of you switch off, you can state your name.
Absolutely. For the record, Lennon Weller, through the chair, Representative Guerra. Yes, there is a separate statute that defines how the tax, how the benefit system is financed. It's AS 2320240 or 290, I believe, which outlines explicitly, how, like I said, how tax rates are to be calculated.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Will this increase the employee contribution too, or just the employer? And do you have any idea by how much? It might be in the fiscal note that I missed.
So through the chair, Representative Guerra. Well, in general, any time that you increase the cost of the program, there is going to be a corresponding increase reflected in the tax rates going forward. And we did provide a forecast going out at least to 2024, kind of showing the differences that both employers and employees would pay. If this increase was to go into effect, as Representative Tuck stated before, the taxes are, it's a shared program, the 73-27 splits. So anytime the costs as a whole go up, of course, that increase share stays constant, but the amount needed to be replenished would certainly increase.
And then just to Representative Tuck.
Representative Guerra.
President Peck, and you said through the chair, you said that in all states but two, the employer covers this cost, or did I misunderstand that?
Through the chair, yes, that's correct, that Pennsylvania and New Jersey are the only two other states that, and it's I don't remember what the rates are, but they're very low compared to us.
Thank you.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Representative Tuck. How would this, Representative Tuck, how would this affect self-employed people?
Through the chair, I'll let the Department of Labor answer that because I don't know if self-employed people pay into the unemployment insurance program.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, self-employed individuals do not typically pay into the unemployment insurance program, and so this change would not impact self-employed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tuck, this bill seems familiar to another bill that I've seen in the past. I think that was trying to deal with, in the industry, particularly in the construction industry, where companies used to have crews, a lot, within the last 10 years, there's been a movement to take those same people, these companies that used to have 50, 60, 70 people that work for them, and have those folks have to go out and get their own contractor's license. And then they went back to more just a real minimum crew because their costs for unemployment were so high. But now you've got all these contractors that are basically independents working on a sky rise or something like that. And it added complications when somebody got hurt. I think you're familiar with what bill I'm talking about. Is there parts of that bill in here, or how does that all pull together in this, Representative? I know you're familiar with what I'm talking about.
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Newman, the independent contractor one had more to do with cheating the Davis-Bacon requirements because an independent contractor can, if you're a self-employed working on a Davis-Bacon job, you don't have to pay yourself the same wages and benefits that's spelled out in Title 36. So this does not address that at all in any way, but I do understand the concerns of the independent contractors, and of course they can avoid having to, the employer can avoid having to pay all the other burdens that go along with hourly employees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and then just one more.
Representative Newman.
And I believe following along those lines, is because if you're self-employed, you also, I know you pay self-employment taxes and such. And I didn't know if the UC, the Unemployment Compensation Insurance Act, was part of self-employment taxes or not, and if that would increase.
And through the chair, I'll allow the Department of Labor to answer that one.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I apologize. Could you please restate your question?
Because people who are self-employed pay a self-employment tax, I didn't know if unemployment compensation, UCEDA, which is a part of your federal excise tax that the withdrawal that this is taken out of, a portion of that, if that was still part of a self-employment tax. And if it was, then self-employed people would have an increase.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the contributions to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund are not taken from the self-employed individuals. But also to respond to your concern regarding independent contractors, the division, when we conduct audits on the tax side of the house, we actively look for workers that are misclassified and that are being reported incorrectly as independent contractors. And we address those issues with the employer to correct that so that they're correctly reported as employees and employment security tax contributions are paid on their behalf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. For the department, just a question, how, other than, you know, you'll see it on, as an employee, I'll see on an individual check the amount that's withheld. When is that received by you? Is that collected by the employer, and then the employer pays you quarterly? How does that part work?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, yes, the employer deducts the employee's portion of the tax each pay period and holds that in trust on behalf of the employee and then submits that to the department on a quarterly basis.
A follow-up, Representative Pruitt.
Okay, so if the effective date being January 1st of 2018, if this passes after March 31st, they would pay the first quarters based on the initial the initial law. Then they would have to potentially catch up in that second quarter if you're an employee or an employer. Would there be a catch-up that would need to be done if this passes after March 31st?
Sure. Through the chair, Lennon Weller, Representative Pruitt. So tax rates are calculated once a year, and they're effective for the following calendar year. We only calculate them once. I can't speak necessarily to the retroactive nature of this bill, but in terms of how the system is financed, we look at the three most recent state fiscal years of costs, the trust fund balance at the end of September, and then calculate rates for the following January. So my belief would be that no, we wouldn't recalculate rates if this went into effect partway through a calendar year.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. A different question?
Before we won, Representative Tuck, we heard this bill last year, I believe.
Yes, we did.
So was the effective date still the same as when it was initially introduced, or is that an amendment that you want to see?
Yeah, so right now the effective date we have on there is January 1st, 2018. So depending on the will of the committee, we may want to change that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for hearing that. Another question that I have is, and this is would be to Representative Tuck, Section 2 tends to turn this from something that the legislature would handle, and I understand probably the desire by the sponsor to take it out of our hands, as it's been several years since this change has been made. But this seems to put it more in terms of a kind of an automatic process. It really takes it out of our hands. My concern, of course, is the elimination of legislative control of these particular things. why was it determined? I want to make sure. Why was it determined that she wanted to do this? And if this is considered as to you as important as the Section 1, which is the initial increase portion, which is kind of the meat of, I think, what the intent of the bill is.
Through the chair, we looked at this. I think the last changes that we had might have been in 2009, I believe it was. And so things have fallen backwards, making Alaska really dead last on the formula. So the U.S. Department of Labor recommends to having a 50% of the average wage. Alaska currently right now is at 28.8%. And so puts us in with other 36 other states that have an automatic factor just to keep us right at that 50% of the average annual income. And the factors that go in with that all spelled out in that Section 2. So that's the reason why we did that, is so Alaskans don't have to fall behind on that. It's an automatic factor. And the department did include in your packet a chart that will show what those taxable wage bases were predicting all the way up to 2024.
Follow up, Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And at some point, I know the department came in with that particular sheet, but I may have to ask them again because I'm still struggling to figure out. They've got two columns, the differences for, especially for the max employer, cost per employee, and I can't figure out exactly how their numbers correlate. But that might be something that they might need to address with this. It doesn't, the math just doesn't seem to add up. So, anyways, thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Newman, and then Tope. Oh, I forgot, Grant. Thank you. Representative Newman, then Tolton.
Thank you, because this is a follow-up basically on Representative Pruitt, so I guess it's timely. On the point that Representative Pruitt had there, I notice it says that on line 14, the department shall increase weekly benefits after December 19. So does that mean that the benefits will continue to increase and stay at that 50% of average weekly determination continually from now on into the future as the average wages of Alaskans either increase, and will it go down as it decrease, or does it stay at a set amount like it currently is, and it would take legislation to change it? Or does this automatically go with like inflation or however?
Okay, thank you for the question, Chair. It's going to be changed annually, but it's going to be locked in for the next year based on the previous year. So it'll be locked in, but it'll be an annual calculation on that. And if I'm wrong in that, let the Department of Labor correct me, but that's pretty much how it functions. So they have the wages are going to be determined by December of each year, and I'm sorry, annually before November 1st, and then we'll use that calculation to determine the benefits from January 1st on.
Just a short follow-up.
Representative Newman.
And then just for clarifying then, so that this will increase so that it stays, increase or decrease, depending on the average wages of Alaskans at 50% of the average weekly determined rate, so it'll just stay at that into the future without legislative approval. It can be changed?
Yes, through the chair, that's correct. And if you look at the chart that they gave us, it's being forecasted to go up a notch, but then start going down and then start creeping back up again. I think that's a result of what the economy that we're seeing right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Phil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We may have had a little discussion on this when you talked about the bill before, but there are the TVET funds, which are technical vocational education program funds, come from those unemployment funds. And can you just refresh me on if there's any effect on that? And are there any other things that are part of the unemployment funds that we pay out of those?
Okay. Through the chair, thank you very much. No, it's not going to affect the TVEP and STEP grants or anything like that, but I will allow the Department of Labor to explain why.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Tilton, this legislation does not impact the way the STEP and the TVEP programs are funded. Those programs are funded through a portion of the tax that is collected from employees. That portion is dedicated to STEP and TVEP prior to the rest of the tax being deposited into the UI Trust Fund. UI Trust Fund monies can only be used to pay benefits. So those other training programs that you might be thinking of, those are funded through different federal grants that the department receives.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the bill where you go up every $2 for every 250 in individual base period, does it have to reach the 250 to go up to the $2? Or if it hits 240, does it not go up? And if it doesn't go up over a course of, if you have 4 or 5 months when it goes up 240, it would go up almost about 700 and... $69, there would be no increase. Is there a point where there's a true up at the end of the year, or theoretically would they be falling behind?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, and this is Representative Tuck again. So if you look at the current schedule, this is extending that all the way up to get to that $510 weekly allowance. Weekly benefit because of trying to make that 50% recommendation with Department of Labor. So it's already kind of calculated that way for the lower incomes, and so to reach that 510, we just extended that same formula. Every $250 increase in wages earned, another $2 in weekly benefits. So that gets extended all the way through, and then from there on is the calculation. So. So from there on out, it may go up and down, but that basically, that Section 2 formula is just being applied to Section 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So theoretically, the next month when it passed the 240, it would automatically go up?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, actually it's going to be locked in annually each year, so it doesn't change. It's only going to be one calculation per year. There's not going to be multiple calculations going along.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Into the department. Actually, let me first ask, is there anyone that can speak to the fiscal note here? I know it's done by OMB. There's one done by OMB, and I don't know if the department's the right people to answer that.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I will let the department or OMB respond to any questions that you might have about that fiscal note. And there is a representative here, I believe, from OMB.
Okay. And I have a different question if that person wants to come up while I ask the other question. One is, so this the other question was for the department, so one of the department members need to stay up there. In using your little chart that you guys have given us, one of the things that I recognize is that we see the employee percentage of contribution at the average rate class goes down over the next 5 to 6 years. What is the mechanism that makes that happen? It goes from about 33% to about, if this were to be put in place, to about 22%. What causes that? How is that calculated?
So, Lennon Weller again, through the chair, Representative Pruitt. That's a fantastic question. In any given year here where you're seeing a share of 33.33%, essentially, as the share for an employee, that's the result of employers and employees being at the minimum rate by statute, which is 0.5% for an employee and 1% for an employer. So at those rates, just mathematically, an employee pays a third of the total cost. As you come off of those minimums, as costs increase, as we're expecting them to under either the base scenario or this projection with the increase, you get back closer to the 73.27 share. And that's simply a result of coming off of those minimum tax rates.
Okay. Sure. I think I understand what he was describing. If it's okay, if I can ask the question of OMB related to the fiscal note, unless someone wants to follow up on that.
And before we go there, Representative Guerra had a question.
Thank you. Either for the division or Representative Tuck. So if I look at page 7 of the bill, currently if you make $42,000 a year, you get a $370 benefit. And that's what you got in 2009, that's what you got in 2010, and it's the same amount that you get in 2018. That hasn't gone up. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's correct.
All right. So through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
So annually the buying power is going down for somebody who gets laid off, and the intention of this bill is to assume that somebody who was making $42,000 a year 10 years ago, as their wages go up, maybe with inflation, their benefit goes up, and that's sort of the proxy for having the benefit sort of reflect the increased cost of living over years. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, that's correct. And whether someone is making $42,000 or making double that, $84,000, they're still locked in at that $370 a month. And I just want to say that someone, I'm speculating, but I assume that someone that's making $84,000 a year probably has a higher mortgage, probably has higher expenses, so we just want to be able to maintain those property values and everything else for that level of income as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to ask questions. Representative Tuck, what about people who have filed for disability insurance? You know, they may get hurt on a job as a workman's comp type of an injury, but their injuries leave them debilitated to the point where they can't go back to work, and so they have to get disability compensation insurance. Does this increase those disability type payments? And I'm not real familiar how that works, but would it affect people who are getting that disability insurance also?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, this bill is just dealing with the unemployment insurance. There's a separate workman's comp formula and everything else based on craft, based on risk, and so on and so forth. I don't really know. I mean, this bill isn't going to address it, those that are injured on the job. But for those that have disabilities that's not due to their workplace, I think will fall underneath something else as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I didn't know if disability type insurance fell under workman's comp insurance standards.
So, Representative Pruitt, back to this. Thank you for being patient.
No, not a problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to ask specifically about the OMB fiscal note. This, you've given us an indeterminate fiscal note, and obviously, as we're talking, as the employer being as the state being an employer of over 20,000 people, there's obviously a cost to us associated with a bill that increases cost to employers. So what I'm trying to understand, you've got an indeterminate note, which probably should speak to that. That means that we probably have an indeterminate. It would be indeterminate telling employers what their costs would be. But I'm trying to dig down and get a little bit more of understanding of why it's what the estimate might be. On the back, on the second page, you guys highlight that there were 1,515 fewer state employees in calendar year 2017. Help me understand. You've got some numbers here that really don't help me even kind of estimate what the cost of the state might be. Can you help fish that out for me?
Certainly. Through the chair, for the record, my name is Caroline Schultz. I'm a policy analyst at the Office of Management and Budget. So, Representative Pruitt, let me just walk through some of the model we put in this fiscal note to try to help illustrate what the potential cost could be. We used our actual costs and our actual state liabilities from 2017 and then modeled them as if this legislation were in effect during calendar year 2017. So as you can see here, we did have about 1,500 state employees who qualified for benefits under unemployment insurance. And just to take a step back, I just want to remind the committee that state employees and the state as an employer doesn't pay into the unemployment insurance fund through the traditional tax that most private sector employers do. We reimburse the fund as the state. So if a state employee makes a claim against the fund, the state reimburses the fund, and that reimbursement comes out of our working reserve fund. So I just want to make sure that that's clear to the committee. So had House Bill 142 been in effect in 2017, this is just an exercise just to kind of assess potential costs. The cost difference to the state would have been $456,600 more out of the working reserve fund in 2017 calendar year, because we actually paid about $4.4 million in calendar year 2017, and had those, the I said here, the 487 claimants who would have qualified under this higher rate schedule, had they qualified for this higher rate greater than $370, our total cost would have been $4.9
million. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that kind of helped kind of fish out exactly what they were trying to get at with this, so I appreciate it.
Thank you. And so I guess that is going to be the fiscal impact would have been in 17. If the inflation adjustment wasn't included in this bill, would you be able to do a determined fiscal note?
Because, through the chair, Mr. Chairman, because I cannot say how many state employees will be claiming against the unemployment insurance fund and what their base wages will be with enough certainty, that's why OMB has chosen to do an indeterminate fiscal note for fiscal year 19 and the out years, because there is the unknown factor of the number of claimants and their base wage rates.
Testimony, and so we have a number of people, and we'll ask that people have their testimony in a relatively short period of time if they can. Let's try to limit to 3 minutes each at the maximum, but let's start with Trenton English. Are you here? And after him will be Joshua Garden.
Thank you.
Go ahead and state your name and who you're affiliated with the record. You go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Trenton English. I am the Southeast rep for Alaska Laborers, and I just got a short little thing here, and it's I'm here to basically show my support for House Bill 142, which I see as a big step in the right direction at helping our fellow Alaskans out that lose their jobs in this time of skyrocketing rent and just the overall cost of life just getting more and more expensive. So in short, it'd be nice to see our unemployment benefits reflect that and take into account the rising costs. And that's all I have to say. Thank you for your time.
I just want to say welcome on board.
Thank you.
Could you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record?
My name is Joshua Gardner, and I also am with Laborers 942. I'll make it short and sweet. Construction's been really hard this year, and we don't know what it's going to be like in the years to come, but if I'm lucky, I work 7 to 8 months of the year, making about $1,000 to $800 a week, and when I am unemployed, I go, I'm making $370 a week. That makes it very hard to raise a child and keep a roof over your head, especially if unexpected bills come up. So I am for this also.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Are there questions, Mr. Gardner? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's Sydney Williamson and then John Morris. Welcome, and I like your app.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So would you go ahead and introduce yourself and your daughter for the record, and go ahead.
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair and Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Sydney Williamson, and I'm a single parent in favor of HB 142, and this is my daughter, Macy. Through the chair, I want to share with you a little bit of my story to hopefully persuade you to increase the weekly unemployment benefit rate. 8 years ago, my daughter and I were without a place to live. We stayed at the Women's Homeless Shelter until I found an apartment I could afford. I worked jobs I didn't particularly enjoy to pay the bills, rent, and lawyer fees. I was going through an ugly, expensive divorce. We made it through that time, and 2 years later, I was able to finance a two-bedroom mobile home. I went back to school, and now I'm a carpenter for the local 1281. And that's where we are today. I'm thankful and grateful to have a roof over my head and to finally have a job that I love. And I worked hard for it, and I will continue to do so to support my daughter. I don't feel that I'm asking too much to expect a fairer unemployment rate than what we have. I have the same bills as anyone else, and we have to have a roommate to afford to live in Juneau. The nature of our work is temporary. Before one job is over, we are worried about when the next job will come. But all of the carpenters that I know love what they do and don't want to do anything else, regardless of injuries or extreme weather conditions. I was part of the crew that built the new snow removal building for the airport. I was outside in the freezing cold weather working hard 6 days a week. I never missed a day and I was never late. But now it's over and I'm out of work. I don't want handouts and I don't want to be on any type of assistance program. I just want to work. And in between jobs, I want to be able to afford to live and pay my bills. I shouldn't have to deplete my savings to do that. Carpenters are here for you, for the city, to build our buildings. And we hope you'll be there for us. I'm asking you to please consider raising the weekly unemployment insurance benefit rate. Thank you for your time.
Representative Gutenberg.
Thank you, Macy. And Macy was the one who gave me the quote earlier today. And we hope to see you in 30 years representing Juneau.
Thanks.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
And John Morris and Kylie Larson after her, after him. John Morris here.
You did a good job.
Can't miss that. Kylie Larson. Is Kylie Larson here?
Good afternoon, Chair and Committee. My name is Kylie Larson. These are my children, Ian and Colby. I've come here today in support of HB 142. I've come before you as a mother, a sister, a daughter, because you all may know someone a lot like me. We live in a state whose economy thrives the most in the warmer months. The construction, fishing, and tourist industries are all of Alaska's biggest assets, all of which either struggle or are completely on hold until late spring or early summer, leaving those of us who are dependent upon these industries struggling to find work and pay our bills. Now, I'd like to share with you my story. I am a single mother and a first-year apprentice in the Carpenters Union. I broke my hand on December 5th, making it mandatory for me to leave my job so my hand can heal, and during the coldest and one of the busier months of the year. Now that I have the clearance to work, the work is scarce. Every employer, including non-construction related, has told me, come back in April or May. This can be very discouraging to some. The average daycare charges about $900 per month per child. That's $1,800 total per month just so I can get out to find work. Then we have to consider food, gas, and rent, all of which we know is not cheap. All of these factors leave myself and hundreds of other hardworking people seriously contemplating relocating to another state. Raising our unemployment benefits could be all the difference between whether or not I can feed my children. Please consider passing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room? Lance Nelson in Fairbanks, are you online?
Can you hear me?
We can now. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and your affiliation and go ahead?
Yes, this is Lance Nelson with the Iron Workers, Local 751. Thanks for the opportunity to testify on this bill, Chair. We're definitely in support of this bill. We all know we haven't had the best economies in the state in the last few years. One of the problems we've seen is when the work gets slow and we have to do some layoffs and we have our workers that are collecting these unemployment benefits and it's not enough. So they end up leaving the state to places like Seattle and the lower 48 where the work's good, and then some of them never come back. And one of the things they say, it's steady work, and then when they are unemployed, their unemployment's better than ours. So a bill like this will hopefully help keep some of these workers in this state. The other thing, the 370, I mean, that's not a good amount of money to try and raise a family on in this state. We're one of the highest costs of living, you know, in the nation, and yet we're one of the lower costs for unemployment in a very seasonal working state. The other thing, like it was mentioned earlier, money that is put out in unemployment goes directly back into our economy. This is money that is going to get spent as soon as a lot of these families get it. That's groceries, that's rent, that's gas, that's heating oil in their houses. It's not luxury money that they're able to go out and go on vacations. It's desperately needed money for most of these families. Anyways, I'd urge you to pass this bill, and that's all I have. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. And are there any questions for Mr. Nelson? Seeing none, thanks again for your testimony. And is J.D. Wilkerson there in Fairbanks in the off-net?
Hello. Can you hear me?
We sure can. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself and your affiliation for the record and go ahead with your testimony?
Yeah, my name is J.D. Wilkerson. I'm the president of the Alaska Steel Erectors. I represent approximately 16 contractors with the iron workers of Local 751. Also a second-generation owner of Griffin Steel up in Fairbanks. I am for passing this House Bill 142. You know, as you all know, the construction industry in Alaska is real seasonal. The last 2 years, I've seen my volume of work decrease by 50%. You know, I'm seeing a lot of increases in jobs to bid this year, you know, so I feel the future is really looking up here for the state, you know. In the last 2 years, I've also seen a lot of young Alaskans have to leave the state, like Lance had mentioned previously, to go to work elsewhere. You know, we need to help these guys stay here. You know, like back in November when Senator Murkowski was her closing statement for opening area 1022 at Anwar, you know, she said, as Alaskans, we have options. And at the end of the day, we all want to get to the same place, and that is that we have an economy that allows us to stay in the most amazing place And no matter where you live in the state, you have to have the ability to stay there. And when you live in a cold place like we have, you have to have the means to keep warm. And I feel that by passing this 142, we'd definitely be giving these guys a hand up. So that's my thoughts on it.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Wilkinson. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you again for your testimony. Let's go to the Anchorage LIO, where first we have Dustin Swadek, and followed by Ryan Andrew. Mr. Swadek, are you there? Not hearing anything, so if he is left, is Ryan Andrew there? Have we lost our connection to Anchorage? No. Kevin Mackey, are you in Anchorage? And Vince Baltrami. I'm not seeing anything, and I don't see that they have left. So we're going to take a brief at ease and make sure that our lines are open. Be back on record, and we want to go back to the Anchorage LIO and see if our connection is reestablished. Is Dustin Swadek there? Is the Anchorage LIO monitor there? Can they call in? Somehow we're not hearing anything. So we have Dustin Swadek, Ryan Andrew, Kevin Mackey, and Vince Baltrami listed as wanting to testify from the Anchorage LIO, but it seems like we have a connection, but you're muted up there because we're not hearing anything here. Can you check your connection? And we did receive a text that they are having trouble on their outgoing telephonic. So we'll take another brief at ease and come back in a moment or two. come back on the record here in Juneau, and we had four people to testify in Anchorage. Is Dustin Swadek there?
Yes, I'm here.
We hear you. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and go ahead and proceed with your testimony?
Dustin Swadek, representative members of Carpenters Local 1281. I'm in support of House Bill 142 to raise unemployment benefits from its current rate of $370 per week. A lot of the work done here in the state of Alaska, particularly in the trades, is seasonal work. We have one of the highest costs of living in Alaska and one of the lowest rates for unemployment benefits. Our members, along with other trades, go through an apprenticeship class to further their knowledge in not only a job, but to advance their skills in a career where they earn wages that will allow them to help stimulate Alaska's economy by not living paycheck to paycheck. With the raise to the unemployment, unemployed workers will be better able to meet their financial needs until they can go back to work. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Ms. Fadik? Seeing none, Ryan Andrew, would you go ahead and identify yourself and who you represent?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Ryan Andrew. I'm with the IBEW Local 1547. Represent a number of electricians in the state of Alaska. Here today to speak in support of House Bill 142. As we're all well aware, the state of Alaska right now is experiencing some tough economic times. And as a result of that, we have seen firsthand several of our members that have left the state unable to find work here. The increase in unemployment insurance will allow them to stay in the state. These members have been trained here. They live here in Alaska. They're Alaskans that work and provide for their families here. So I'm in support of this bill because it will keep our workforce here in Alaska where they belong and not force them to travel outside to find other work. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Andrew, is there any questions? We've seen none. Thank you again, and let's go to Kevin Mackey. Kevin Mackey, are you there?
Hi, it's Kevin Mackey.
Would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
My name is Kevin Mackey, and I'm here representing the members of Local 2520, the Pile Drivers and Divers of Alaska. About 220 members of ours who work a very, very seasonal career. And something like this would be a major benefit, especially in the wintertime. I'm a constituent of Kathy's Tilton, and there's a fair number of us that live in the valley. Pretty much going to mirror what everyone else said. The cost of living is high. The unemployment insurance is low, so I think raising it raises the bar for everybody. This isn't just a labor issue. This is for everyone in Alaska. So that's where I'll leave off. Thank you.
No questions. Vince Beltrami, are you on there? Can you introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Vince Beltrami, for the record, president of the Alaska AFL-CIO, representing approximately 50,000 plus members in the state of Alaska. I want to kind of maybe take a little bit different tack. Well, first of all, on the amount that's currently in effect at $370 a week, I was involved in that effort nearly a decade ago. Since then, just due to inflation, people that are collecting that $370 have lost an additional $62 a week. So the benefit is even worse than what it appears to be. And when we're in wage replacement, 52nd, so behind every state in the union, as well as Puerto Rico, the District of Columbia, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, something certainly isn't right with that picture. And it's rather pathetic, and I know we can do better than that. We've got over 1,000 building trades members currently that are working in the lower 48 because they couldn't wait it out up here with such a paltry wage replacement And this is something that, and looking at, through the bill packet, one of the things that struck me the most was the AWIB letter, which is the Alaska Workforce Investment Board, which is made up equally of some of the largest employers in the state as well as union representatives. They submitted a letter, their resolution essentially, that was unanimously endorsed to support HB 142 because these employers, as well as the union representatives on that committee, understand the importance and the effort that's gone into training construction workers and other workers throughout the state. In fact, that's what that board is charged with, is the development of our workforce in the state. And they understand the importance of having a ready and available workforce who's there to fill those jobs when the construction season or whatever other industry it is gets engaged again. And not having a adequate wage replacement doesn't leave much incentive to keep those folks around. And again, as has been pointed out, we're one of only three states in the country, and we're the one state that pays the most, our workers, taking out of their pocket to put into this as well, which I think is fair, that our employers are willing, our employees and employers are both willing to invest in keeping a good, trained workforce around. So we obviously support this. In terms of can the state afford to do this, when you look at the UI Trust Fund, currently it has close to $500 million in it. It's healthy, it's robust, it's fully solvent, and giving an adequate increase, which still isn't going to put us near the top of the pack, despite the fact that we have some of the highest earnings, the highest cost of living of any state in the country. We still aren't going to be anywhere near with this increase what Washington and Oregon are paying to their unemployed workers. So it's certainly high time. While I know that, you know, it's typical that the NFIB is going to weigh in opposition to this bill every single time, it was heartening to look through that bill packet and see all the number of employers as well as employees who were weighing in and support, because we know that it's time. And with a big hopeful gas pipeline on the near horizon and the work that's going to be necessary staging up to that project, we have to make sure we have as many of our workers here as we possibly can to have them ready to go to work on those projects that are going to be necessary to make that project happen. So without a doubt, the Alaska AFL-CIO strongly supports HB 142, and we encourage you to move it out of committee and get it to the floor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 142? Is there anyone else online? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. Is there further discussion on the bill from the committee? Seeing none, remember that the deadline for amendments, and they should be drafted by Ledge Legal. Yeah. For both bills that we consider today is 5 p.m. on February 6th, and we will hear these bills on February 7th. Intention will be to take up amendments and vote on those bills at that time. So is there anything further to come before the committee? And we can get out of here early, so by a few minutes. So we will be adjourned at 3:22. Oh, wait a minute. I forgot, back up on 142, I had a request from Representative Newman for the Department of Labor to come back up. There was a question. Representative Newman, you want to restate your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question on the history of unemployment, of when the last time it was raised, if the calculations were changed at all, and how the figures are worked, or a little history on where we're at.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the last time the maximum weekly benefit amount was raised in Alaska was effective January 1st, 2009. Prior to that, the maximum weekly benefit amount was $248. So if you look at the current page 5 of the draft bill, where you see 248 over in the right-hand column, that's where the benefit schedule cut off at that time.
Thank you. Are there any further questions for the Department of Labor or for the sponsor of the bill? Seeing none, I encourage everybody to work with any amendments with the sponsor, and we will be adjourned at 3:23.